And now, Christ in Pop Culture presents Persuasion with Aaron Straza and Hannah Anderson. I'm Aaron Straza, and with me is Hannah Anderson. We're your hosts for Persuasion, the place where fine ladies, rational minds, and the best kind of company gather to discuss all sorts of ideas and issues. Thanks so much for joining our conversation today. It's part of our series called Growing Viral, Well-Being in the Age of Corona. And each of these episodes will look at ways we are responding and reacting to the COVID-19 pandemic. And then we're seeing how we can move toward wholeness in this era. Now, in our previous conversation, we highlighted some general ways that this crisis is revealing how we think and how we operate. And now it is time to dive into something specific.
It is. And it's going to feel like a deep dive right away.
Oh, yeah.
What hasn't been a deep dive in the last 3 or 4 weeks? I feel like I know I'm an adult, but I feel like I became an adult at another level. Yeah. Even in these last 3 weeks, my kids are like, Mom, what else has happened in your life that is like this? I'm like, nothing.
Yeah, nothing could prepare us for this. No,
nothing.
Not at all.
But to help us do that today, we didn't feel completely adequate, just you and me, Aaron, right? Mm-hmm. So even though we are the fine ladies of this podcast, we felt like we needed to bring on some of the best kind of company. So we have invited our friend John Stark, who is a pastor in Manhattan and the author of the recently released book, The Possibility of Prayer, to come be with us today to help us process our responses and reactions in this moment. So, John, welcome to Persuasion.
Hey, thanks. If I'm not a fine lady, what should I be called?
Well, you're the best kind of company.
You are.
So there's fine ladies, rational minds. You may fall into that category too. We'll let you overlap. And the best kind of company. So you can fill that space.
Okay. We're so glad you're here, good. John.
Oh, thanks.
Now, John, you are in Manhattan, and you're a pastor, and you and your wife and kids have been there for, what, 8 years? Is that, or is it longer than that?
Just a little under a decade.
Okay.
Wow.
Okay. So could you first tell us what life is like right now for you all? What has changed in the last 3-4 weeks for you as a family, as a church, as communities? You're pretty close to one of the major epicenters and outbreaks, at least nationally. So what does life look like right now?
It feels ever-changing. Feels like every day something's different. Just a few weeks ago, we were just beginning the plan, Holy Week and Easter and what all that might look like. And then suddenly we went to, how do we do church gatherings over Zoom and things really quickly. So now it's just sort of, okay, how do I make sure everyone's doing okay? How do we think about money in the bank? How do we think about making technology work for us? We have a number of healthcare workers in our church who are, on the front lines of a lot of these things. So staying in contact with them, talking with their spouses, working through anxiety on that level. And just trying to, at some point, because we're all away from each other, there's an element of trying to do the best that you can and connecting with everyone, but at the same time, just sort of trusting God for what you don't see. And that's probably more challenging than I thought it was going to be. Other than that, we're like surprise homeschoolers and in a small 2-bedroom apartment with our kids. And so.
Well, John, I so appreciate hearing this from you, because you are much closer to the epicenter of one of the major outbreaks. Just as Hannah had mentioned, for me, I'm in central Illinois, so I'm about 2 hours south of Chicago, and just far enough removed from what's going on there, where our city is having some cases, and there has been loss of life already, but it's not quite as intense. And so I think it's so easy for someone who's a bit removed like me to feel a little bit like this unknown, like what you said, you can't see it. It makes it feel a little bit easier to downplay it. And it really kind of highlights the tendency, I think, to see some of the denial that we've been seeing in commentary. And so I really appreciate you being here to speak to some of that, because that's really what we want to get into today, is what is this response that we have to deny what's really going on?
Yeah. I would second what Aaron has to say there, that being in the country, in Virginia, being removed from even more densely populated areas, it feels like it's a threat. It's a real thing. But in my daily life, while my daily life has changed, I can't hear stories from real people in my real life that are experiencing things. So it still feels very distant, very far removed. And I have seen this response or this reaction from folks who are at a distance that, well, this is not a real thing, because we haven't necessarily experienced it or know anyone who is directly involved with the work.
Yeah, it's a very real thing. We have a few people in our own community group who have the virus and having to be at home with their family and kind of worrying through what the future might be, or how that'll impact, just because we're still unsure of like how this will impact our lungs in the future. So there seems to be a recovery, but what is our lung capacity after experiencing this? And some, you know, some are older, and in, you know, the one like big pastoral thing, just even wondering, like, I can't visit some of these people in the hospital. So just sort of like ordinary pastoral care that is sort of an impulse isn't available. And, you know, what we just had a big phone call with a bunch of pastors who are trying to figure out, okay, we're actually losing members, they're losing their life. And we don't know how to do, because we can't gather for a funeral. And so this grief process is just sort of very strange, confusing, prolonged, and it can't be done in company among friends. And so it's just this weird, confusing time of like, how do you lead a church, a congregation in a plague? And there wasn't any seminary class that taught you how to do that.
That's so sobering too. To hear you speaking right to the heart of this, that we are so accustomed in grief and in tragedy to gather and to be together and to support each other in that way. And this is one of the things that has changed. Like, we all have to figure out a new way to do this. And it's so hard, because we need each other physically to support each other in crisis, and we're not able to do it. And I think that's one of the things about some of the common things I'm seeing with denial, where it feels like it is sort of minimizing or sidestepping the real loss that we are facing, because we can't be together. And people have tossed out things like, oh, but there are all kinds of deaths all the time. This isn't that much different. And it's like, well, yes, it is, because all the deaths are happening all at once, and we can't all be together, and we can't have funerals, and we can't have grieving like we usually do. There's such a loss there. And I think that's been my frustration with kind of like this this quick turn to deny or to minimize what's going on, because it really is affecting how we can even process what's happening to us in society.
Yeah, and I think that's one thing that I want to make sure we say clearly and directly, is that there's a reason that we might move quickly to kind of a minimization. It's not that people are just being just political or just whatever or just uncaring, or even our own temptation to live and say, well, maybe it's not as bad as there's a reason we react in this way. And I think it's, at some level, it's just too overwhelming. It's been so unprecedented in our experience. We don't have a frame of reference necessarily for this kind of large-scale crisis, both to our physical health, but also to, you know, people's livelihoods, the disruption of education. And so we are all facing grief of different kinds. We're all isolated and alone from each other in that grief. And so what else are we going to do? I mean, like, how else are we going to cope with it?
Right, right. Yeah, to try to deal with the reality. Yeah. Uh-huh.
So I think there's like this wishful thinking sometimes, and I've engaged in it. I remember even a week or two ago, I was like, well, Easter is going to be really nice when we can all be back in church together. Like, and it was this kind of hopefulness of maybe things will be back to normal. Maybe this is just a temporary thing and we can get over it and get on with things. And I think embedded in that is, I think we lack mechanisms or skills or practices that allow us to face this and to actually name and lament the grief that we're experiencing. Now, John, you can come in and say something very pastoral and
yes, please. Yes.
Well, I think one of the big challenges for our setting, and I'm sure it's everywhere else, is we're used to being able to do all kinds of things, whether it's performing at work or whether it's being entertained or reaching out relationally, or just even good things of being together. And some of those normal comforts are removed and we're just sort of left to ourself. And what we have with ourself, we don't always like. And so, or what were the emotions that come to the surface when we're left to ourselves we don't like. And so some of the normal ways in which we reach out and numb those emotions are taken away from us, even good ways like serving. So many of the ordinary ways of serving people, of just human touch, of being together, of even delivering groceries is a challenge. Some of those things are removed from us. And so we're left with a kind of weird isolation and dormancy that we're extremely uncomfortable with and we don't know quite what to do with. And even just among us pastors, I think there's this sort of performative spirituality where we are screenshotting all of our Zoom calls that we're having with people and putting them on our social media so that we're at least giving evidence that we're productive, that we're getting stuff done, we're doing things still. And, you know, people already think we only work one day a week. And what are they thinking now? And so just trying to give some evidence that we're being productive, we're performing, and I think we're being proven that we don't know how to be a people who have like hidden lives, quiet lives. And because when we're left to ourselves, or we don't like what we have, or we're very uncomfortable with it. So, you know, when I'm doing pastoral counseling over Zoom calls or phone calls, the biggest pastoral counseling issue is suddenly what people are finding is there's rage and anxiety. Some of it's rational. Most of the time it's irrational that my boss can't see everything I'm doing. And so I'm having to constantly be anxious about, do they see that I'm doing this? Do they see that I'm working my time? Do they see that I'm worthy of my pay? And we're so used to having this performative aspect to our existence. And so much of it now, apart from social media, unfortunately, but so much of the other ways that we find our meaning and performance is taken away. And so we're just sort of left with a good bit of anxiety, and we're having to kind of reckon with that in ways that maybe we haven't before.
All of that you're describing, I mean, I can relate to all of those things. And even what you're saying about how there's this discomfort and kind of like coming to grips with where you are, with how you used to measure your success, and now that's stripped away or it's changed. That to me is exactly why we are so prone why we desire to move toward denial. It's like, let's minimize this thing and let's make it not so bad, because dealing with all this that I have going on inside, the emotional turmoil of it, oh, it's just so overwhelming. But I think that even in the midst of that, it is influencing our perspective and our reactions, our responses, and we can't find that wholeness that we are talking about in this whole series. We can't find that wholeness by staying in the denial. And so we really need tools, I think, to move toward that wholeness and to find a way to face the reality, even if we have to do it in stages.
This episode is brought to you in part by Beyond Ordinary Women Ministries, which prepares Christian women for leadership. At BOW, we believe that every woman is a leader because she influences someone. So, whom do you influence? Do you mentor a woman, serve in the workplace, or do you lead a small group, teach the Bible, or even lead an entire ministry? No matter who or how many you influence, our free online resources will help equip you. Our videos, podcast episodes, and articles from experienced women leaders will encourage you and perfect your leadership skills. They offer wisdom for dealing with ministry pitfalls, current biblical issues, health for your own soul, and insights for shepherding others well. In addition, BOW offers Bible studies designed to connect women of multiple generations. They provide a challenge to both women new to the Bible and those wanting to dig deeper. Be our guest and browse all of our free resources and low-cost Bible studies at beyondordinarywomen.org.
The lacking the ability to respond appropriately causes more suffering, and like you said, it redirects our ability to reach for wholeness, because in some ways, for Christians throughout history, they've known how to be isolated. They've known how to be sort of experience a kind of dormancy, and we've just always called it solitude. So, Henri Nouwen kind of uses this framework of experiencing the sort of desolation and wilderness of isolation and loneliness, mm-hmm. and knowing how to turn it into a fruitful solitude. And in many ways, we're having to experience, at least as Christians, experience, okay, what does it mean for me to be alone and do that fruitfully? Yeah. And to really see our emotions as, and our lives as, seeds. Because if we don't, Psalm 126 describes our tears, our sadness, our lamenting, and our suffering as seeds. So, right, those who sow in tears shall reap shouts of joy. But he who goes out weeping, bearing the seed for sowing, shall come home with shouts of joy, bringing sheaves with him. So with, Jesus, or the psalmist imagines that God is actually using our seeds of suffering, of alienation, of exile. That's the context of Psalm 126. We have this existence that just seems not part of the plan. I don't know what to do with myself. I don't know who I am. And all of those emotions and planting them and as seeds, and God uses that. So there's this honest declaration of what's going on, of what's going on inside me, all my grief. And God uses that, plants it, and it turns into joy. It turns into rejoicing and dancing. And but without that, you know, without the seed, it doesn't produce into anything. So, you know, for many of us, we try to, you know, plant joy when we really should be planting our grief. It's God who turns it into joy. And so for many of us, we just, I think we're very uncomfortable with the fact that we're going to have to be very, very honest. And in a way that a farmer plants a seed to get a crop, we're going to have to plant our griefs in order to get real joy, that lasting joy that's actually meaningful. Does that make sense?
It reminds me a lot of how you write in your book. And I'm just going to tell listeners of Persuasion, you will want this book, The Possibility of Prayer. I like a lot of books. I like a lot of authors. I am happy to share a lot of different books. It's rare that I love a book. I love this book. So go get it. But one thing you write, John, and I'm going to just read this for everyone. This is in the chapter you've titled Outgrowing the Reactionary Heart. A life of prayer and stillness with God is the place reactionary hearts go to die and be raised as something deeper. We must be alert to the formation of our spirit and our soul. And I think that's very much akin to what you're saying here, is that there is this deeper work that God is doing, and it becomes clear in the stillness and in the kind of forced, even in these moments of forced isolation, where what God is doing in our souls and our spirits is this work of taking our grief and our lament and making it fruitful. You also talk in this chapter about how that happens even more practically, and you kind of direct readers toward the Psalms. Yeah. Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, I can't remember the exact phrasing that Calvin uses, it, but he describes the psalm as sort of just like the directory of all of human emotion. So, you know, in some ways, when we are going through deep and heavy emotions, we actually feel like we're being acted upon. So we don't feel in control of our surroundings. We don't feel in control of ourselves. And so we don't really probably know what to say oftentimes. And the good thing about the Psalms is that it gives us things to say when we don't know what to say. And so, you know, like if we're in despair, it gives us despairing words. If it gives us anger, if we're angry, it gives us angry words. And you know, I think one of the things is that the Lord knows how to heal us, because he's created us. And one of the ways he uses healings is just getting us to say things to him that are really, really important for us to express, even if it's anger. So Psalm 88 is a really angry psalm, and it's an angry psalm at God. It's a pretty accusatory psalm. You know, it's like, you've done this to me. It ends basically saying, you know, darkness has been a better friend than you, O Lord. And, you know, it doesn't have that redemptive turn where it's like, it starts angry, but it's like, but I hope in the Lord. It doesn't end that way. It ends with just sort of darkness. And that's a pretty uncomfortable psalm, especially since, like, if my kid probably talked that way in a prayer, I'd be like, hey, show some respect. You're praying.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, let me correct that for you.
Yeah. But what's really remarkable is that those are inspired words for us to say. Like, God inspired them. He's not so insecure that he can't hear our complaints. He's not so insecure that he can't hear our anger. He just knows what, you know, what we need to say when we get desperate. And so for us to maybe resist those emotions, oftentimes means that we resist healing, and that puts us in a hard place to be able to function well in wholeness and community. When we're not experiencing healing from God, we're going to reach for it somewhere. Mm-hmm. And that's where sort of having a reactionary heart. There's no peace. We're not looking at it from God. So we're going to force peace where there isn't peace. Or if I'm out of control, I'm going to force control. But what we really need is to bring those longings, emotions to God and give him a context to and a playing field to heal our emotions in that way. So the Psalms are just sort of the place in which God draws us in and says, okay, you're feeling a lot of things and I have a lot of things for you to say to me. And that's just one step of healing. I mean, it's different than grumbling. The Israelites were grumbled and they were judged, but Job complained to the Lord and was called righteous. So there's a difference, you know, one sort of grumbles one another and the other one brings his complaint to the Lord. And so there's a healing. It's kind of the first step of faith is to express your emotions, whatever they may be, to God.
In a sense, as we move past or through denial and latch onto that honesty, that truth telling that you're speaking of, it seems like then that's where we're able to plant the right kind of seeds. I loved that picture that you're painting there, that we have to sow those seeds to get joy as the harvest. And as I was thinking about the fallout of denial in my life, how I've seen it, and then how I can see it out in regard to this pandemic, it's like if we deny the pain and the reality that this is having upon us, it's like you lose the ability to relate to people. And then if you aren't being honest about what is going on in the world, it's like you're disconnecting from God's heart because he's grieving over what's going on. And so I feel like it's like this flip side of we're trying to push away these bad things, but in reality, what we're doing is we're losing out by not being honest. And so learning how to lament and learning how to be honest, I so appreciate that we can turn to the Psalms and learn how to practice that because we aren't good at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's not a quick move, which is why it's really a challenge for us to be able to sit with the Psalms and mm-hmm. allow those emotions to come to the surface, because they oftentimes feel like our worst enemies are coming to get us.
Well, I don't think any of us are going anywhere anytime soon, so we have that. Yeah.
We have time and space. Is that what you're saying, Hannah?
Well, I have noticed in my own life that the forced isolation, the forced slowing down of my life has given me space to create better opportunities and better habits in mm-hmm. terms of prayer. Mm-hmm. And it has been, for me personally, the combination of, okay, I'm gaining a little more control over my schedule in terms of I am home.
Right.
And also the sheer weight of what's happening. I have nowhere else to turn. I have nobody else can give answers. I look at my spouse, I look at my kids, I look to friends and family, and I look to the government, and nobody knows much more. They're not much further along. I don't mean that there aren't experts. You understand what I'm saying. But we're all kind of learning this moment together. And so in my own life, there has been an unexpected welcome and a humbling, I have to say truly humbling, rebirth of prayer because of the moment. Yeah. And my hope is that it is something that will outlive the moment.
Well, I think, you know, if you go to Matthew 6, where Jesus is teaching us how to pray in the Lord's Prayer, and he's getting at the very, he's sort of like, what does a prayer look like if you really are poor in spirit? What does it look like? That means you ask for everything. Like, everything is dependent upon a gracious Father. Yeah. You're extremely needy. And here you suddenly are, we're suddenly put in a world where we are extremely needy. We can't control how everything is happening. We're at the mercy of our circumstances. The only thing we can do is pray. And I think what Jesus would tell us if he was sort of present and preaching the Sermon on the Mount again, I don't think he would say, oh, now you're more needy than you were. It's just now mm-hmm. just being exposed as just, this is actually how needy you are. You know, Jenna, my wife, she just texted me about 30, 40 minutes ago, so excited that she could order food from Costco because it usually takes like 2 weeks for them to deliver to us just because it's so backed up and the markets are all empty of just sort of some ordinary food. Like, we had to order bulk of 50 pounds of flour. I have no idea where we're going to put 50 pounds of flour in our apartment. But just like for the first time, you know, we were sitting over dinner the other night. It's like, well, let's pray for our daily bread. We don't do that. And we actually need to, and we should have been all along. And I think Jesus in some ways is showing us, this is how needy you are, really. You're dependent upon my good grace all of the time. And so, you know, one of the big hopes for me, and at least my community, and I think probably for Christians all over, is that as we sense more and more our dependence and neediness, will actually experience more and more his provision and presence and care. So, you know, for so many of us, I don't think we've been aware of just how numb or, you know, distanced we are to God's presence and care. And we just don't feel needy. We don't feel vulnerable to it. So now we're just almost either, we'll either be hardened and bittered, or we'll be completely open and vulnerable, and we'll experience that sort of renewing sense of his presence and care. And so, which is why, you know, we've been using here in our community that this could really be a fruitful dormancy, in a way that a seed has to be planted in the ground and just has to open up to all the resources of the soil. And, you know, in some ways we kind of have to die to being in control. We have to die to being the most productive person in every room that we walk into. We'll be the most productive person in every room we walk into, because it's the only person in the room is me, for most of us. But there's no performing right now. It's only being seen by God right now. And it's a new existence. It's a new kind of way of thinking about ourselves that people have denied for so long. And so it could be just a really, really fruitful season for many of us. And when we come out of this dormancy, it'll be a kind of new fruitfulness with new resources we just didn't know we had before.
Well, John, that word about making this dormant time fruitful in terms of our pursuit of God, I feel like that is just such a needed message. And it's hopeful, even though it's facing the reality that things are just so difficult right now. And I'm just so appreciative that you're here talking with us and joining this conversation. I appreciate your gentle insight and your manner. I think that so many people who are listening are going to appreciate that. So thank you so much for joining us and being with us. Yeah, we so appreciate it. Yeah. Well, that's going to do it for this installment of our Growing Viral series. But listeners, you can jump right into the next installment, because those are all downloaded and delivered. They're right there for you to listen to. In the next episode, we are talking about the uptick in anger and frustration that come with living in this viral age.
You have been listening to Persuasion with Aaron Straza and Hannah Anderson, an official production of the Christ and Pop Culture Podcast Network. Please rate and review the show in iTunes and check out our other shows at christandpopculture.com/network. Theme music by Maiden Name.